Or what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. An intense manhunt continues in Germany and across much of Europe for the chief suspect in Monday's deadly truck attack on a Christmas market in Berlin. 12 people were killed and dozens injured when a driver plowed a large truck into a crowd of holiday shoppers. Authorities are searching for a 24-year-old Tunisian national. The Islamic State is claiming responsibility for the attack, but it's unclear if the suspect had been in touch with the terror group. Final evacuations of rebels and civilians from the northern city of Aleppo have resumed after being delayed for one day. A spokesman for the UN Secretary General says evacuations took place under less than ideal conditions.
Protection of civilians leaving these areas remains the biggest concern. The process for evacuation was traumatic, with crowding and vulnerable people waiting for hours and exposed to sub-zero temperatures.
The complete evacuation of the rebel-held enclave will give full control of Aleppo to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, a milestone in the nearly six-year-old civil war. The evacuations are being conducted under an agreement negotiated by Russia and Turkey that also called for people to leave two villages that have been under rebel siege. Meantime, the United Nations General Assembly adopted a resolution to set up a panel to investigate and gather evidence of possible war crimes in Syria. Mexican authorities have identified fewer than half of the victims of an explosion or multiple explosions at a fireworks market that killed at least 31 people and injured scores of others near Mexico City. The forensic experts are using genetic analysis in an attempt to identify the burned remains. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said the assassination of the Russian ambassador earlier this week was carried out by a member of the network of Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen. Turkey's foreign minister told U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in a phone call earlier this week that his government believes the killer is linked to Gulen, who lives in the United States. Mr. Erdogan has also blamed Gulen for July's failed coup. Gulen condemned the attack early this week. The United States has rejected as absolutely ridiculous suggestions that it was involved in or supported the assassination because of Gulen's presence in the U.S. President-elect Donald Trump met the heads of two major airplane builders, vowing to bring down the cost of multi-billion-dollar government contracts. The executive officers of Boeing and Lockheed Martin, along with several generals and admirals, met with Trump on Wednesday. Trump said, meantime, that the attacks in Europe this week proved that he is right about his plans to institute tough screening for Muslims attempting to enter the United States.
An attack on humanity. That's what it is. It's an attack on humanity. And it's got to be stopped.
Trump spoke to reporters in Florida, where he is continuing to interview candidates to fill key positions in his administration. Gambia's longtime president, Yahya Jammeh, says only Almighty Allah can deprive him of if he seeks to overturn the results of this month's presidential election. Opposition candidate Adama Barrow beat Jammeh in the December 1st election, and he conceded defeat at first, but now contends there were voter irregularities, and he is asking the court to overturn the results of the vote. The Supreme Court has scheduled a hearing on Jammeh's appeal for January 10th, 9 days before he is supposed to give up power. And violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo has left at least 21 people dead. The violence broke out amid demonstrations against President Joseph Kabila, who remains in office even though his term has ended. A court ruled that he should stay in power until elections, which the ruling party has set for 2018. Opposition demonstrators are demanding Mr. Kabila step down. A group of Roman Catholic bishops brokering talks between the opposition and the ruling party are calling for an agreement between the two sides by Sunday. For details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That's voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. In the DRC, the main opposition coalition looks forward to a country without President Kabila at the helm.
Kabila is no longer the head of state here, and I think it's important that we get to an agreement as soon as possible. Just make sure that we have an orderly management of state affairs between now and the elections.
Freddy Umbuyamu Matungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party. Can the opposition defeat of Gambian strongman Yahya Jammeh be replicated in next year's Liberia presidential election? We'll have a conversation with the publisher of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper. In Cameroon, a call for severe punishment for traffickers of pangolins.
According to the 1994 wildlife law, anybody arrested or found in possession of part or whole of a protected wildlife species is presumed to have captured or killed that animal and is liable to a prison term of 1 to 3 years.
Eric Kabata is the deputy director of the Last Great Ape Association. South Sudan refugees say armed men are committing atrocities. Solar pump brings better days for drought-hit Zimbabwe herders. And an ancient Chinese herb helps fight against tuberculosis. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a leading member of the largest opposition coalition known as Rassemblement says the group expects talks with the government will end on Friday to ensure the beginning of a smooth transition process ahead of possible elections early next year. Freddy Umbuyamu Matungulu, leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, says President Joseph Kabila's continued stay in power after his second and final term expired on December 19 contravenes the constitution. He tells viewers Peter Clarty that Mr. Kabila's continued stay in power is a flagrant violation of the constitution.
We are, as you know, beyond the 19th of December of 2016. De facto, Kabila is no longer the head of state here, and I think it's important that we get to an agreement as soon as possible so that we can just make sure that we have an orderly management of state affairs between now and the elections. So it's not an ultimatum, it's just a restatement of the fact that the time is running short. We are already beyond the 19th of December, and for that reason, we don't have much time to waste here.
What exactly do you want to see as opposition members in the Rassemblement? What do you want to see on Friday?
What we're working on is the outline of a political settlement that would put the country in a position to sort of restore some level of efficiency in the management of the services here so that we know if we agree on a deadline for holding these elections that the services, the administration, everybody's going to work feverishly and in an efficient manner so that we can keep those deadlines. I think that's some of the things that we'd like to see happen in an agreement that hopefully can be signed before or reached.
But the Electoral Commission is saying it needs time, at least a little over 14 months, to prepare adequately to organize the election. So in this case, if that timetable will be followed, does that mean that President Kabila will stay in office in a transitional period up until that time, or you want a different time frame for the Electoral Commission to organize and administer the elections?
We think that it is possible to organize these elections in 2017. We've got many experts testifying to this. And I think, we want a time frame that is very short in terms of when we will sort of resolve this legitimacy sort of crisis that we have in the country. So 2017, we've heard from experts, is a reasonable sort of deadline for holding this presidential election.
Does that mean that President Kabila will still remain in office as you hold the discussion and prepare for elections to be organized? Is that the agreement that you're trying to settle in the ongoing dialogue?
Well, it's very difficult. I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen, because Kabila is now just one of the people in this country. And he strange the group of everybody here who's never been elected. And so we all are looking into this situation, and we have to determine who we think will rule the country between now and then. You don't go with the assumption that it's going to be him, because he's no longer legitimate. He changed us, and we'll look into all the talents that we have here, and in the last analysis, we'll determine who will be the head of state and who's going to participate in the running of the country with whoever we decide would be the head of state during this interim period. But I think it's important just to make sure that, or to understand that, given that we haven't had an election, we cannot have a normal presidency anymore. We cannot have a normal presidency. It's going to be something that addresses the very specific situation in which we are. That's what I think is important that we're looking into in working on this agreement.
Freddy Ombuyamu Matungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotte from Kinshasa. Although Gambian President Yahya Jammeh has had a second thought about his defeat in the December 1st election, nevertheless, his stunning downfall has got other countries soon to have their own election thinking about how the Gambian opposition was able to beat a strong man like Jammeh. Nowhere is this being looked at carefully than Liberia, which holds its own presidential election next year. Rodney Sear is publisher and managing editor of Liberia's Front Page Africa print and online publication. He once lived in the Gambia as a newspaper reporter. He says it is yet to be seen whether Liberia's opposition political parties can come together the way the Gambian opposition did. Besides, he says, Liberian opposition politicians have a history of not working together.
July 22, 1994, I was in the Gambia when Yahya Jammeh took over. I was fortunate to be one of the first journalists to interview him. I was dispatched there along with the late Mamadou Seka to interview Mr. Jammeh. And because I was coming from Liberia, the first question I asked him was, are you going to be another Samuel Doe? Because he looked the same. He looked young. He looked, energetic. And his answer to me was, I'm not going to be a dictator. The reason I asked that question was that I wanted to put him on the spot. It's been 22 years after that interview, and to see this happening now is very, very, very disturbing. When the elections were held, it's a rare thing to see a dictator lose an election that he called for, that he respected. He won 2 or 3 times already. So why is he still in power? That's the question. But the thing is, Liberia had a similar situation with Charles Taylor.
That's what I wanted to ask you, yes.
In 1997, Charles Taylor was running for president. And they had all these opposition people. They couldn't decide among themselves whether to run separately or to come as a group and run against Charles Taylor. Had they done then what Gambians did now, perhaps Charles Taylor would not be president today. But they chose to go their separate ways. And people are saying that because Ghana has just changed power, that Gambia elections went to the opposition. So it means Liberia too would have the same thing.
So do you think there's a correlation?
The concern there is that although this trend is taking place, because the Liberian opposition are not united, they're not coming together in a timely fashion, we may not see that trend bucking in Liberia because it all depends on the numbers. George Weah has been in the second round in the last 2 elections. His party, CDC, is regarded as the most populous party. At the same time, their numbers have shrunk since 2005-2011. Weah's problem has been that they say that he's not educated enough to be president. He's not experienced enough to be president. So because he went second round 2 times already, there's this belief that he might go second round again. So who goes there with him? There's Charles Bromskin, the opposition Liberty Party leader. There's Mr. Cummins, a former Coca-Cola executive who's also running. There are a lot of other people running. Penina Yure from the NPP range from Charles Taylor era, he's running. And the former central bank governor, Mills Jones, is running. The field is very crowded. We have 22 or 23 candidates running for president. The fact that they cannot, among themselves, decide to come together, it sends a signal that they may not be able to beat the incumbent.
So, of course, you said the incumbent means Vice President Joseph
Boakai. Joseph Boakai, yes.
So is he also trying to have a coalition or is he going it alone?
Well, the bottom line here is, James, none of them have money. Money wins election. Money is part of the process. Each one of them have lapses. Boakai seems as too old to run. By the time the election is held, he may be almost 80 years old. And people are saying he's too old. He's been with Ellen Sirleaf all this time. The government have been accused of being corrupt. Bromskin, they say he's the most experienced, but he lacks financial resources. And he has this label that he's the ethnic Baxter tribe. It's his strong following. Weah has the experience issues. Alexander Cummings came on the ground 18 months. So although he has the experience and he has the knowledge from Coca-Cola, he's considered not just an outsider, but he came on the ground too late. He may not have the time on his side to reach all of the various constituencies in the country. Nevertheless, he's been making some inroads in those areas. He's been going to the villages, the towns, and, you know, meeting people. And his agenda has been, like, he wants to restore the economic and the business environment back to where it was, at least before the war. So, yeah, he's trying to, you know, reach everybody, which is a good thing. Whether he succeeds, it remains to be seen. But the major concern for everybody, including international partners, is that the opposition has still not been able to formulate themselves in the strong block of three or four coalition that's really, really strong to upset the ruling party. There is concern also that they may not have the resources to upset the ruling party. It doesn't mean that Mr. Boakai is assuring to win. He has some challenges. Like I addressed the issue of his age, the issue of resources.
And how does he distinguish himself from 12 years of being vice president?
And that's the problem the opposition is facing, because they have not been able to address that issue and take him head on those issues.
Rodney Sear is the publisher and managing editor of Liberia's Front Page Africa print and online publication. He was speaking with me in our Washington studio. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 22nd. Let's send shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Radio Life, in Lofa County, Liberia. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. South Sudanese fleeing the conflict in their country say armed men are committing atrocities and abuses against civilians. The refugees say extrajudicial killings are also common in areas that they were forced to flee. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Nearly all the refugees arriving the Bidibidi camp in Uganda's Yumbe district over the past few weeks hail from the former Equatorial state. Most of them fled from Lanya, Yei, Morobo, and Kejikeji. Chaplain Malesh says he fled his village in Lanya earlier this month when government soldiers and proxy militia began shooting villagers indiscriminately.
The Dinkas came to our area at a place called Kirba, started shooting. This made people to start running. If you see your neighbors running, why should you stay? That is when we decided to escape to Uganda.
Malesh, whose father died in the early 1990s and whose mother also passed away some 10 years ago, says as the shooting continued, many villagers fled into the bush and hid there for days before making their way to Uganda. On the journey to Uganda, Malesh says he and his group met hundreds of other South Sudanese fleeing the conflict because of fighting. Clementina Danga, a mother of four from Morobo, was among them. Speaking in Arabic, Danga says government soldiers came to her home one day in September and killed her husband as the children watched.
When they came to our home, my husband began to run. As he was running, they shot and killed him. We then decided to run off into the bush.
Danga says she and her children did not wait to bury her husband. She says they ran into the bush where they stayed for the next 2 months. Danga says armed men, whom she identifies as government soldiers, committed other abuses in her village, forcing many people to run for their lives. Patrick Taban, another South Sudanese who fled from Yei, says he personally observed many atrocities.
I witnessed very many. The Dinkas shooting the civilians, innocent people, what. That one I witnessed. Even one of my neighbors was shot. The kids were shot. They were just shooting anyhow. That one I witnessed.
Danga says soldiers did not even spare women as they rampaged through villages.
The Dinkas are killing people, including any women they find. That is why we are running away from South Sudan.
Taban says rampant insecurity since July has resulted in a humanitarian catastrophe that is driving thousands of people each day to cross the border into Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
All the people are seriously, they are suffering. There's no food, people are moving up and down. Even more of them are coming on the way by footing, beating the children. Some people even are throwing their bags on the way. Even the clothes, what things are washed. That's why people are living. People are dying of hunger.
Manish says people in his village had expected a good harvest this year, but the conflict that erupted in Juba in July between the South Sudan Army and troops loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar has forced farmers to flee, leaving their crops behind, which is pushing whole villages to the brink of starvation. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Apiku, in Kampala.
Communities in one of the most drought-prone parts of Zimbabwe are ditching farming in favor of cattle raising with support from the United Nations and a local NGO. Sebastian Mofu traveled to the Lupane district of Zimbabwe and reports that the experiment appears to be working.
Matafeni village, about 600 kilometers southwest of Harare, is in Lupane district, one of the driest places in Zimbabwe. But a solar-powered bore pumps water into a trough where some cattle are drinking. The bore supplies water for a deep tank just a few meters away, which helps reduce the risk of waterborne disease. Tembani Kumalo waits for his 12 cattle to finish drinking. He says before the bore was drilled, his children would have to miss school to take the cattle long distances looking for water. He says we are taking our heads to the deep tank weekly, and diseases like lambskin, which used to affect our livestock, can now be controlled. There is a very big difference. He says fewer livestock are dying and their healthier cows are fetching better prices at the market. At every bowl, there's also a fodder garden to ensure livestock in the region have enough food throughout the year. The Matafeni deep tank and borehole were rehabilitated by a local NGO called Lead Trust and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO. Southern Africa is still feeling the impact of El Nino-induced drought conditions. Subsistence farmers here have not been able to harvest enough to eat during the past two planting cycles. An estimated 4 million Zimbabweans are currently food insecure. Low rainfall in the Lupane district makes people there especially vulnerable, said Lead Trust District Program Manager Lucia Manyisa.
We want these farmers to earn a better living from the livestock. If each animal or a third of that is sold at $500 an animal, that's a lot of money. And not many households ever harvest. If they do, maybe it's only for consumption.
Dorcas Sibanda owns 6 cattle. She says, I can now do other house chores while cattle are drinking from the trough. Plus, I no longer disturb my children's learning. They can take their time at school without hurrying them home to help. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Matafeni Village, Lupane, Zimbabwe.
Cameroon says it has intercepted more than 670 kilograms of African pangolin that authorities say were being smuggled from Cameroon to Malaysia. The pangolin is the world's most trafficked mammal, and conservationist groups are calling for severe sanctions on the three traffickers who have been arrested. Moki Edwin Kizika reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon Customs Lieutenant Wara Wara François Noël of the Yaoundé Simalène International Airport told VOA the recovered pangolin scales were found in several meat packets. He said the three smugglers had bribed their way into the airport, but authorities were mobilized after getting a tip from wildlife officials. He says 2 weeks after the tip, his staff finally intercepted the truck loaded with pangolins at the plane bound for Malaysia. He says although it was the first large-scale interception of the protected mammal at the Yaoundé Nsimalen International Airport, authorities say they have been regularly seizing 3 to 5 kilograms of scales and meat of the pangolins hidden in little containers. 6 months ago, Hong Kong authorities announced a massive seizure of 4 tons of pangolin scales that had arrived from Cameroon and were being smuggled to Asian countries. Among the organizations assisting officials in this ongoing case is the local NGO, the Last Great Ape Association, or LAGA. Its deputy director, Eric Kabata, says traffickers have often been able to buy their way around sanctions when caught in Cameroon.
According to the 1994 wildlife law, anybody arrested and found in possession of part or whole of a protected wildlife species is presumed to have captured or killed that animal and is liable to a prison term of 1 to 3 years and or a 10 million maximum fine. If the law were applied as it was supposed to be applied, would have been seen many criminals, wildlife criminals, behind bars.
Some cultures consider pangolin meat a delicacy and use pangolin scales in traditional medicine. High demand has fueled an international criminal trade that has severely threatened the survival of the world's 8 pangolin species. It is estimated that more than 1 million pangolins have been snatched from the wild in the past decade. In September, the world's largest wildlife protection convention, known as CITES, recommended a complete ban on international commercial trade. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Scientists have found that a drug used to treat malaria may also help fight tuberculosis, which affects 1/3 of the world's population, viewers Jessica Berman reports.
Scientists don't know by how much artemisinin might shorten the length of TB treatment in humans, but research in the test tube suggests that it could have a significant impact. That's because although active infections do respond to treatment, the bacterium that causes tuberculosis can lie dormant for years, a state in which it's largely resistant to antibiotics. That's why it takes 6 months or more to treat the disease. Now, researchers at Michigan State University have discovered that artemisinin, a mainstay of malaria treatment, keeps the pathogen that causes TB from becoming dormant. Microbiologist Robert Abramovich, a TB expert, says that's because many people who start taking antibiotics begin to feel better in a few days. As the active microbes are killed, they stop taking their pills, potentially creating antibiotic-resistant TB strains.
It's the dormant bacteria that take a long time to kill. So if we can kill the dormant bacteria with, say, the artemisinin or some of the other compounds we discovered, we can maybe shorten the course of therapy, and by doing that, we can reduce the sorts of clinical behaviors that are driving the evolution.
That's VOA's Jessica Berman reporting, and that's it for this Thursday, December 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Colotti and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.